Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today, today we're focusing on health and wellness. And I gotta say, the timing couldn't be more perfect or more hilarious, really, given that I've been nursing a bit of a head and chest cold this week. So please bear with me. But honestly, a cold is small potatoes compared with some of the health challenges many people deal with on a daily basis, both physical and mental. And today we're bringing you some of their stories. We'll meet a man who's pursuing his acting dreams even as he loses his vision. We'll find out how a local woman is dealing with intense claustrophobia this holiday travel season. And we'll talk with members of the DC Sled Sharks, an ice hockey team for kids with physical disabilities. But to kick off today's health and wellness show, we head up to the studio of an artist whose own health and wellness, not too long ago, were hanging in the balance.
So your class is downstairs and then your studio is up?
Yep.
This is Jay Jordan Bruns.
So you've got two floors.
Yep. That's why it's the best studio in Maryland.
Jordan, as he's known, is the resident artist at Glen Echo Park in Maryland. He teaches classes in the park's famed Yellow Barn and creates and displays his paintings and drawings up in the old Stone Tower.
I've been in the Stone Tower since 2000 and right after brain surgery, 2007.
It's kind of hard to hear in the tower's echoey stairway, so in case you missed that, in 2007, Jordan underwent brain surgery. $1 million brain surgery, in fact, at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda.
I was rare enough of an illness to qualify for one of their studies, and once I was finally back to normal, it actually took about a year.
When you say normal, what does that mean?
Not diseased. healthy. Thinking back to where I used to be once upon a time.
As for what once upon a time means, Jordan's doctors suspect it was probably around high school, which the Ohio native attended in a suburb of Cleveland.
And I was the first student to go to art school from my high school. And then I was in Baltimore, so I have a kind of affinity with Maryland.
But it was in Maryland, at the Maryland Institute College of Art, that Jordan first started noticing something was off. For starters, he was gaining weight.
I was 50 pounds heavier than I am now.
Lots of weight.
Really bulbous face, and I have a buffalo hump on my back, my neck, but I had very skinny arms.
And he knew this wasn't a case of the notorious freshman 15.
You know, I was vegetarian diet and running 5 miles a day, yet I weighed over 200 pounds, so there was something not right.
Then, when Jordan got into the MFA art program at Indiana University, he found he was really struggling with memory.
And I wasn't remembering a lot of what my instructors were telling me.
And focus.
I had 6 bodies of work. I produced more than anyone else in my program, for sure, but they got frustrated with me, and they just wanted me to focus. And actually, I got put on probation.
Finally, he decided enough was enough. He went to IU's health clinic, and after hearing Jordan's symptoms, the clinic's doctor said, look, this is kind of a long shot.
But I'm going to test for Cushing's disease, and lo and behold, that's what I had.
Cushing's disease is caused by a tumor on the pituitary gland, right at the base of the brain, and that tumor overstimulates the production of the stress hormone cortisol.
A normal person's between 1 and 10 on their cortisol level, whatever doctors measure cortisol with, and mine was over 400.
Cortisol controls your body's use of carbohydrates, fats, and protein. It helps reduce swelling and inflammation. It also affects your mental state. So too much cortisol and all those things get out of whack, which is why the doctor thought to test Jordan for Cushing's disease.
So she thought you might have it, you were tested, you came out positive for it, and what was your reaction?
Oh, it was relief. You know, I was very unhappy with the way I looked, and my memory was terrible, so when it finally got resolved, you know, I had some sort of depression issues just because I felt so terrible, but I thought this was going to be something I had to live with for the rest of my life.
And, of course, it wasn't, thanks to the surgery Jordan eventually received at NIH, which, again, was a kind of experimental surgery, since most cases of Cushing's disease...
Apparently, it's more prevalent in women and dogs and horses.
Don't occur in guys.
The actual probability of me having it, I think we calculated it to 2 in a million men.
As to why it took Jordan an entire year to recover after the surgery, you have to remember, basically, his body had been addicted to cortisol.
My body was fiending for cortisol.
Ever since the tumor appeared during his high school days. So his doctors...
It was essentially being a heroin addict and then removing all your heroin.
Had to wean him off.
So I was taking medication And during that time period, my pituitary gland, which had been asleep for 9 years because the tumor was taking over, was slowly starting to wake up again and do its job.
And now that Jordan's pituitary is back in business and he feels normal again, to borrow his word,
I'm back to running. I'm back to producing artwork on a daily basis.
He says he feels forever indebted to NIH for getting his life back on track. That's why earlier this year, he started a fundraiser for the Children's Inn at NIH. Back in May, 5 Glen Echo artists painted in the bumper car pavilion as the Washington Conservatory of Music performed jazz. The event raised $10,000 for art therapy programs at the Children's Inn. This year, Jordan says the money will go toward music therapy.
And you said this is kind of your way of giving back?
Yeah, I didn't have to pay for my surgery, so this is my way of saying thank you. And they do a really wonderful job at the Children's Inn of making that environment friendly for kids. I can see myself, if I was a younger kid, really appreciating that kind of opportunity to not be in a very stark hospital.
And of course, Jordan hopes he won't wind up in such a place either. Like, say, if the tumor comes back?
I run the risk of losing the pituitary gland if it does come back. As of now, I'm off hormone replacements. I don't wake up and go through withdrawals of feeling sick and nauseous all the time. But, you know, there's always the chance that it could come back, but it's less now than ever.
As for how Jordan Brunz's bout with Cushing's disease has affected his art, well, he's always been fascinated by the cycle of destruction and rebirth. And now he says that theme takes on a whole new meaning in his artworks, many of which depict sweeping, almost surreal stone buildings, often crumbling and falling down from the inside and out.
You know, the destruction, I think I was doing it to myself during that time period. But also the rebirth is still there, so there's always kind of a glimmer of hope. And some people kind of walk in the studio saying, oh, it's very post-apocalyptic, it's very depressing. And I'm like, well, yeah, and that's part of what life is. If things die, things are reborn. And I think that cycle is true to me. You know, it feels like it came through experience in a way.
For more on Jordan Brunz, Glen Echo Park, and the Children's Inn at NIH, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Sometimes, as with someone like Jordan Brunz, an experimental treatment works, and a person can get back to life as more or less, you know, normal. But in other cases, a medical diagnosis might force someone to confront a very different future with a very different definition of normal. Case in point, D.C. resident and actor Justin Purvis, a man on a mission to watch his dreams come true, while he still can. Jessica Gould brings us his story.
Justin Purvis has the kind of stage presence that makes him instantly recognizable, even in a crowd.
Welcome to Burlesque Bellyland! My name is Rob Tender, and I'm your host with the most tonight, so give it up for me.
But if you're sitting in the audience, chances are he won't recognize you.
I don't know where Mike is. Oh, Mike!
Purvis first discovered there was something wrong with his eyes at Boy Scout camp when he was 12 or 13.
They all ran off in the night to go play Capture the Flag, and I ran out there. I didn't get lost, but I just realized that I can't see anything. I don't know how these people are maneuvering around in the dark.
After a few years and countless hospital visits, doctors finally diagnosed him with choroideremia, a degenerative eye disease that can lead to total blindness.
I remember obviously feeling that the world was ending. When I talk about it with people, I say to them, that was the point that my childhood ended. But I know that I still had fun and did stupid childhood things. But I definitely began to look at the world in a new way.
In fact, Purvis literally sees the world differently than most of us. Choroideremia is hereditary, linked to the X chromosome. The disease usually affects males, and it's very rare. Researchers estimate only 6,000 men in the U.S. have it. The rate of vision loss changes from person to person. At 35, Purvis has 15% of his eyesight left.
I use the term when people ask me about it, I say it's donut vision, or bagel vision if you want to be healthy, I guess. I have limited, extreme peripheral vision. Centrally, I can see what's right in front of me, but then there's that section of the donut all the way around where it's completely, it's a dead zone.
On good days, he can still see well enough to navigate city streets and perform with his improv group. Then there are his bad days.
There will be times where I'm reading a book and my eyes will just stop focusing. And then all of a sudden the words just kind of just whoosh. And then I have to put down the book and walk away and like look at something very plain, like look at a white wall or something and try and get back to it. It's really annoying.
The worst part, Purvis says, is there's nothing doctors can do about it.
Justin Purvis.
What? Yeah.
Who called me?
There you are.
Right there, my blind spot.
How's your eyes been doing?
I'm going blind. So, you know, but they don't seem to have changed much since the last time I was here.
What's the smallest line you can read here?
A-P-E-D.
For years, Purvis tried to hide his disease.
If I tripped over something, I would stand up immediately and do like a gymnast pose to be like, aha, I stuck the landing. So I would just be the fool. So you'd forget that I had stumbled over something or I'd run into somebody.
And he developed little tricks to help him manage social situations.
Every time I meet somebody new, I look down at their waist to see if their hand's coming out. Or I've started like putting my hand out first, just beat them to it to be like, yeah. Or I'll just hug people. It's just easier. And makes it fun, because it's a little awkward when you just hug a stranger.
Of course, Purvis says there are times when the difficulties of his disease and the fear of his future wear on him.
I think in those times, I think to myself, I hope that I go to sleep and just wake up and I've lost my vision. Like, I wouldn't have to deal with the waiting. It would be over. Now I just have to deal with getting on with my life. But then I go to sleep, I wake up in the morning, and I can see still. And I shake it off.
So these days, Purvis is doing his best to embrace his life, illness, and all. Last year, he and his brother, who also suffers from choroideremia, took a cross-country trip to see America while they still could. A couple of documentary filmmakers came along, and the movie about their experience, called Driving Blind, is now in production. Then, a few months ago, Purvis quit his day job to concentrate on acting and improv.
I think when you're rich... And back me up if any of you rich people live in that house. You can do anything you want. It's almost like being pregnant, I feel like. Because when you're pregnant, you're like, I want pickles and ice cream now! And the husband is like, well, I just need to leave. Good, perfect excuse.
Purvis, who has watched his eyesight diminish to a tiny fraction, says performing makes him feel like he's 100%.
Getting on stage, having no idea what I'm doing, no idea what's about to come, just trusting that I'll make it somehow.
And in that way, life is a lot like improv. You can't control what you're given, but at least you can control what you make of it. I'm Jessica Gould.
To see photos of Justin Purvis performing and to learn more about choroideremia and the search for a cure, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Time now for a quick break, but when we get back, how birds adjust their songs to compete with the buzz of the city, and why noise can make a big difference when it comes to the well-being and survival of our feathered friends.
What's interesting is, what are the species that don't occur here anymore that have already been impacted, where their distribution has changed? And that's a much more, when they're absent, it's a difficult thing to really understand.
That and more coming up on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today we're talking about health and wellness, and in order to keep ourselves healthy and well, what's one of the things we might do?
We're going to test your acuity. So if you just want to stand near the door here, we're going to be using this chart on the wall.
Why? Go to the doctor, of course, for our regular exam or checkup, like, say, for our vision.
You cover your eye and read the smallest line of print that's visible to you.
F, D, P... L, T, C, E, O, maybe.
But unlike the eye exam we heard before the break during Justin Purvis's story, the eye exam you're hearing now...
Okay, can you cover the other eye now? And if you can see the same line, can you try to read it backwards this time?
Well, this exam has an instructor.
So the part about read the same line backwards, so why backwards?
Because I might have memorized it from the first time and, like, will recognize the letters, so they just saw it, so... try to change it up a bit.
But not just any instructor. We're in a mock examination room at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences. The doctor and patient you're hearing are actually first-year medical students. And the guy asking about reading the same line backwards isn't a physician on GW's faculty, nor is he a fellow med student. No, this guy...
My name is Ray Alcala.
...is a standardized patient instructor, or SPI.
How do you describe to people what it is you do?
Basically, I explain that I instruct medical students, usually first, second-year medical students, on the physical exam system. So, you know, your HENT, your pulmonary, cardiovascular, abdominal, musculoskeletal, neurology.
So that explains the I part of SPI. As for the SP, you might have heard how medical schools often use people, actors, as well as others, to play the role of a patient and act out various conditions and situations for medical students to practice on. Well, these people are known as standardized patients.
I started out as a standardized patient, simulating roles, and then these programs started cropping up where standardized patients became instructors. And I just found that fascinating to learn what it was that all these students were performing on me all these years, and to be able to give them feedback on what they were doing.
GW's standardized patient instructor program cropped up pretty recently. It's just in its second year now. And Jennifer Owens.
I'm one of the SP educators here at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences.
Who I met recently in a busy classroom is kind of the standardized patient instructor, I guess you could say. She trains SPIs like Ray Alcala on GW's physical diagnosis checklist.
Basically, what we feel needs to be incorporated into a head-to-toe physical exam.
With a focus on technique. So in a mock exam room like the one we were just in, a fourth-year student helps first-years with the more nitty-gritty medical details.
So if a student has a question like, where is a specific lymph node located or why am I doing this? The fourth year is there to give that information.
But if a student has a question like, for instance,
how do I use the otoscope? More of a technique question? Well, that's what the SPI is there for.
And as Ray Alcala explained to me after his session with the students, the SPI is there for something else, too.
I also got the feeling that you were sort of bringing in a patient's perspective. You mentioned something about, don't forget, everyone has a different eye level.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, because a lot of times students as doctors don't really realize the different issues that they have to deal with. And we were just covering visual fields there, checking their peripheral vision. And I've had really tall students checking visual fields, but they're thinking of where their fields would be for them. They'll do the maneuver, and they're not getting the results that they're expecting. And I can say, oh, and by the way, when you notice the results were a little off, consider the fact that we have a height differential. And I think that they appreciate that perspective.
Between his stints as a standardized patient and standardized patient instructor, Alcala says he's managed to create a full-time gig. For others, though?
I'm Josh Drumright.
It's more of a part-time thing.
Yeah, so I come in for these things because they're in the evening and easy for me to do around my day job.
What is your day job?
I do background investigations for a federal agency.
But part-time or no, just like Alcala, Drumright says he relishes the opportunity to teach medical students.
You feel like you have a hands-on, interactive, important role in medical school, and it's a growing part of medical school. More and more medical schools are doing programs like this. It's fairly new for GW to have just regular people have such a large influence on the teaching process.
And while Ray Alcala agrees this involvement of, what, lay people, I guess you could say, is a positive thing, he says it's not without its challenges, such as gaining the students' trust.
I think a lot of students will look at, oh, well, you know, he's not a doctor, he's not a fourth-year medical student, you know, why should I believe what he has to say? But I think that if you demonstrate that you're confident and you speak the language, so to speak, all of a sudden they open up to you.
But Alcala says it kind of works the other way, too. Being an SPI helps him look at these budding physicians in a whole other way.
We know how many years and how much training they go through. But when you work with the students the way that we get to work with the students, you know that they're real people and they're great people. And I just have such a great appreciation for what they do and what they have to go through to be able to care for all of us.
You can can learn more about standardized patients, standardized patient instructors, and the national association dedicated to educating them on our website, metroconnection.org. So medical school presumably comes after many, many years spent on the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And we're getting new information this week about how healthy D.C. public schools are when it comes to educating the city's young people. Joining us now with the details is education reporter Kavitha Cardoza. Hi, Kavitha.
Hi, Rebecca.
Now, this week, we saw the release of something known as the Nation's Report Card. How did the district do?
Well, the Nation's Report Card is a federal education study conducted every 2 years that compares 21 large urban school districts. And what's most striking this year is D.C.'s public schools have the largest achievement gap between black and white students in the U.S., more than twice the average gap seen in other cities. At the fourth grade level, the gap in math proficiency is 60 points, and in reading, it's 64. In cities such as Baltimore, New York, and Philadelphia, the gap is closer to 20.
So I guess the most obvious question here would be, why? You know, why is our achievement gap so much higher than that of other cities?
I spoke with Michael Cassily with Council of the Great City Schools. He says this is definitely an issue city leaders need to address, but he says it's also not as simple as comparing a white score to a black score, because it's also about income.
You're comparing white students in wealthier sections of town who are among the highest performing white students any place in the country with much poorer African-American students in the District of Columbia Public Schools.
Cassily says in a city such as Cleveland, the black-white gap is much narrower.
And it's not because Cleveland has figured out what to do to narrow the achievement gap, but what you're looking at in a place like Cleveland is very poor whites compared with very poor blacks.
Okay, so apart from the achievement gap, how did our students fare compared with the last time they were tested?
Sort of one step forward, one step backward. DC's fourth and eighth graders improved slightly in math, but their scores went down slightly in reading. And it's worth noting that charter schools aren't included in the study, even though approximately 40% of children in the district attend charter schools.
Well, speaking of charter schools, I understand there's some news related to them as well.
Well, they've been working for 3 years on a new evaluation tool called Performance Management Framework, which will show how different charter schools are performing academically.
But my understanding is charter schools, you know, they can vary quite a bit, right? One might focus on math and science, another might be all about, you know, foreign languages.
Right. And charter school leaders say they've worked hard to take all that into consideration. So parents looking for a school can compare apples to apples. The performance management framework is a three-tier system based on a 100-point scale. It looks at multiple academic measures, including test scores, growth over time, attendance, and re-enrollment.
So now that we have this new system, do we know yet how schools are actually faring under it?
We do. 30% of the schools received between 65 and 100 points and are considered the best charter schools in the district. Approximately half the schools fell into the second category of 35 to 64 points, which means they met minimum overall standards. The lowest 20% are in the third tier, meaning they received 34 points and below. Four schools in that category received fewer than 20 points, which means the board may close them at the end of this academic year. Brian Jones is the charter board chairman. He says the performance management framework holds schools more accountable.
PMF evaluates schools in what we believe is a very fair and objective and transparent manner. The idea here is that we really do want to be shining the light on what's really happening in our charter schools, really underscoring what's happening inside those walls so that parents and families and other stakeholders in the district have a real, meaningful way of being able to measure schools.
We should point out, though, that the evaluation system doesn't take into consideration financial management of each school, which is one of the main reasons charter schools fail. Charter board leaders say they'll continue to monitor the financials, but for simplicity's sake, they only included academics in this new framework.
Well, Kavitha, thanks so much for coming in and sharing this report card on the city's schools.
Thanks for having me.
If you want more information on how the district's public and charter schools are faring, you can find links to these new reports on our website. That's metroconnection.org. We turn now from the well-being of our city's schools to the well-being of our city's birds. Turns out the dull roar of city life is affecting how birds sing their songs. Environment reporter Sabri Benashour brings us the latest on what researchers are finding in D.C. and Maryland.
Have you ever been at a bar where it was just too loud to talk to anybody? Ooh, that's better. I said, have you ever been at a bar where it was just too loud to hit on anybody?
Oh, all the time.
Absolutely.
There's times when you can't. Yeah.
I don't go to loud places for that reason.
That's Aaron Connerly, Mikey Maliksi, Lance Bullardick, and Vladimir Stanisic, all at various bars along 18th Street in Adams Morgan.
I mean, it's pointless.
Man, that's terrible. But you know who feels their pain? Birds. Seriously, birds.
We know that birds are adjusting.
Peter Mera is a conservation scientist at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. He says a big part of being a bird is singing. It's often to hit on other birds. And it's hard to do that because it is really, really noisy in a city.
The sounds of trucks.
Air conditioners.
Traffic in general.
It's like living in a bar.
Urban noise, those sounds compete with low-frequency sounds.
So birds with lower songs have to sing differently.
Those low-pitched sounds decline in 5 out of 6 species that we studied in urban areas. So birds have sort of tried to change their songs to higher frequency or mid-frequency songs.
Can you show me a few examples?
Sure. So first I'll play a Carolina wren in a rural area, so where there's very low ambient noise. And this is a recording of a Carolina wren at an urban site where there's a lot of other background noise. And what you can tell is that the pitch of the song of the Carolina wren in the urban site, it's lost a lot of its low-frequency sound.
Here it is again.
Rural. Urban.
It may be hard for us to hear the distinction, but we aren't birds. Birds probably can't much tell the difference between a lame human pickup line and a really good one either. Singing higher probably won't work for humans.
Hey, so do you come here often? Hey, hello? Where are you going?
But singing over the traffic isn't the only problem for birds. It turns out that big buildings distort songs too, especially the highest pitches.
Their songs are compromised by the buildings themselves, which absorb songs and refract songs and sounds bounce off those buildings.
So higher pitched songs, like this house wren's, echo in weird ways and get garbled. So high pitched birds sing lower. That could work for humans.
I'm sorry, I must be lost. You look like you might know the way back to heaven.
Several of the species Mera and his colleagues looked at narrowed the range of their songs, cutting out the high parts and the low parts. So what does all this mean? Mera says, we don't know yet.
Yeah, animals are adjusting their communication. They're changing the way they speak. Their accents might be changing. But to what degree is this changing the number of young they have? Or how well they survive.
Could be that noise is the reason some birds stay out of cities.
What are the species that don't occur here anymore, that have already been impacted? When they're absent, it's a difficult thing to really understand.
Maybe it'll change their language.
That would be an evolutionary question.
Or maybe it'll change what city birds can hear.
Right, so it may be that the bird, the cardinal or the Carolina wren that's also receiving that signal, may be modifying the range at which it receives things.
Or maybe it means absolutely none of these things. But there is a point to thinking about it.
Urban environments pose lots of challenges for animals, challenges we're really just starting now to quantify. When you think about an animal like a bird, it's not just about where they nest. It's not just about where they eat. It's also about how well they can communicate in this urban concrete jungle.
An urban jungle where a good pickup line is key not just to a fun night out, but to the survival of the species. I'm Sabri Benashour.
To hear more bird sounds and to learn how you can get involved with bird research in your own backyard, check out our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, trains, planes, automobiles, and claustrophobia. What it's like to travel when confined spaces give you the willies.
I felt my throat closing in and I couldn't make it. I went a couple stops and then I had to get out.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today we're talking about health and wellness. We've talked a lot thus far about physical health, while this next story is about mental health, specifically phobias. Some people's phobias involve a fear of heights or crowds, maybe spiders. But the phobia with which many of us are most familiar, one all sorts of people struggle with during the holiday travel season, is a fear of flying. And that's the topic of our regular transportation segment from A to B. Jonathan Wilson takes us inside this aversion to airborne travel and explores why some fearful flyers find the problem spreads to other parts of their lives.
32-year-old Kathleen Caggiano says she loved to travel. She had flown dozens of times without a worry. But in 2008, she was flying into Reagan National Airport from Dayton, Ohio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of PSA, the entire flight crew, at this time, we'd like to call for your attention to the airport security. The illustrated card to find located in the seat pocket in front of you.
The flight was full, but she'd been on crowded planes before.
I do remember there was a guy next to me, and he kept kind of bumping into me with his elbow. But I thought, oh, at first he was just trying to get settled in his seat. But then throughout the flight, he kept doing that.
Caggiano says about 30 minutes before the landing, something in her cracked. At first, it felt like an allergic reaction.
My throat started closing in, and I just had the sensation of, I have to get off the plane now. Of course, I realized I couldn't, you know, I'm thousands of feet up in the air. But I've never had that feeling of, like, get me out now.
There's little reliable data on how many people suffer from a fear of flying. A USA Today CNN Gallup poll from 2006 found that 9% of American adults count themselves as very afraid of flying. But the number of people for whom the fears are serious enough to count as a phobia may be much lower. Clinical social worker Jean Ratner, who specializes in patients with travel anxieties, says for about half of the fearful flyers she's seen, the problem has little to do with worrying about a crash or a terrorist attack. The issue is claustrophobia, or a fear of being trapped in a small space.
It is our policy that you keep your seatbelt fastened at all times while seated.
Ratner remembers one client who made her realize that not all flying fears are the same.
This one woman said to me, "You know what? If that plane exploded or had a crash, at least that would be a way I could get out of that plane."
Kathleen Caggiano, who fell into the claustrophobic group, avoided airplanes for about 2 years after her 2008 episode.
My dad and stepmom had retired to Naples, Florida, and so that was hard for me because I ended up driving from D.C. all the way down to Florida. It was 16, 18 hours. It was ridiculous.
And the fear spread. Riding the metro became too much for her, and even driving became a problem when it came to the Fort McHenry Tunnel on I-95 North. Caggiano says she knew she needed to get help after calling off a trip to visit family in Pennsylvania.
I was literally had my car packed. I was at the tunnel, and I couldn't do it, and I got off the last exit and went home, and I told my family I was sick and not feeling well, and that was really hard for me because I wanted to go, I wanted to see everyone, and I couldn't do it.
Ratner says increasing isolation from family and friends is common for travel claustrophobics who aren't getting help. She says many of her clients in the D.C. area are successful professionals who are fearful of getting promoted at work if it means they'll have to travel more. But she says there is plenty of reason for hope, even if it feels as if the fear is insurmountable. For many people, stopping a panic attack before it starts is all about breathing.
Breathe normally and know that oxygen is flowing, even if the bag does not inflate.
Ratner says many people start holding their breath as they start to panic.
With each person, I try and find what will help them get into a natural, effortless kind of breathing. It doesn't have to be anything fancy.
She also makes her clients practice sitting facing a wall for extended periods of time with just a book and a glass of water to simulate an in-flight experience. When they're ready, Ratner even accompanies clients on short flights. Caggiano, who counts herself as a success story, has now flown with Ratner twice.
I have found typically they don't need me very much on those flights, but they know I'm there. Gives them that feeling of just in case they panic.
It's kind of crazy, actually. My family thought I was nuts. They didn't understand. They're like, you flew to Chicago, but you just came back. You fly there and you come back the same day.
Whether it's nuts or not, Caggiano has slowly been conquering her fears. Ratner says it's important for people like Caggiano to practice their coping skills, whether it's breathing or visualization exercises, as they go about their daily lives. And she says even if a fearful flyer feels he or she has conquered the fear of being trapped in an airplane cabin, the battle isn't likely to go away forever.
Most people really need to take at least 3 or 4 flights, even short ones, that year. If they let more than even 6 months go by before they take that second flight, they start to relapse.
Caggiano says she's still working up the nerve to ride the Metro again, but she recently conquered the Fort McHenry Tunnel. And she does have a vacation plan for February with some friends. They don't know exactly where they're going to go, but it will be someplace warm, and yes, they will be flying.
For the first time, I'm actually excited to fly again. Yeah, so I'm very excited about that. And that's been a long time coming.
I'm Jonathan Wilson.
To learn some of Gene Ratner's tips on preparing for long tarmac delays during the winter season, head to our website, metroconnection.org. And we want to know, have you ever had issues with travel-related phobias? If so, what have you done to cope? Let us know by sending an email to metro@wamu.org or find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. It's hard to do a show about health and wellness without mentioning athletics. And our next story is about the guts and glory of one of the more aggressive sports out there, hockey. Emily Friedman headed to Ballston, Virginia to visit the Washington Capitals practice rink, Kettler Capitals Iceplex, and brings us the story behind one of our city's most vibrant hockey teams, the DC Sled Sharks.
The D.C. Sled Sharks are down 4-0 at the end of the second period. A few of the top players are out with injuries, and they're down to 6, just enough to play. No subs. It's not looking good, but the team isn't too discouraged. Actually, they look pretty happy.
They love throwing big hits. Everything about hockey these guys are into.
That's Coach Brian Dutton.
Yeah, we've had kids with spina bifida. We've had amputees. We've had conjoined twins at the head out here. So we had 2 players that were connected at the head on 2 different sleds.
Sled hockey, or sledge hockey, as the Europeans call it, was invented by 3 Swedish wheelchair athletes back in 1961. The athletes decided there had to be a way to translate NHL-style hockey into a game for people who can't use their legs. The 3 Swedes decided that instead of skating, players would sit on a tiny sled with 2 blades under it, blades just like the kind on hockey skates.
And on top of that sled contraption is a bucket that they sit in.
Which is not actually a bucket, but more like a backrest to hold the player's torso up. Their legs are strapped into the sled, and they hold 2 short hockey sticks, maybe a third the size of a traditional hockey stick. On one end is the blade to hit the puck, and on the other end, there's metal teeth, which players dig into the ice to move around the rink.
Shoot!
There it is.
Yeah!
There we go!
Within a year of the game's invention, there were 5 teams in Stockholm, and by 1994, sled hockey made it to the Paralympic Games.
What's nice for the children, too, from a physical point, is that it's the opposite movement than pushing their wheelchair. So if you have a wheelchair user and they're always pushing forward, when they're skating, they're pulling back.
Joan Joyce is the manager of the Sled Sharks. She's also the recreation therapy coordinator at National Rehabilitation Hospital, the organizer and main sponsor for the team. NRH has a Paralympic sports club, which also organizes teams for wheelchair basketball, quad rugby, wheelchair tennis, and hand cycling.
One of my favorite moments was we have one of the kids who's on the team is in high school, and we had just come out, and he was going down the hall in his wheelchair, and this able-bodied kid stopped him and said, "Vitaly, what are you doing here?" And he goes, "I'm on a hockey team." "You're on a hockey team?" You know, and the kid was shocked, and the kid's on a hockey team, so it gave them a connection that they hadn't had before.
In the final period of the game, Connor Delaney is playing defense. He's the youngest one on the team, and by far, the smallest.
I'm Seal Delaney, mom of Connor Delaney, number 25, on the DC Sled Sharks. Connor was born early, 12 weeks early. He has cerebral palsy. Other than that, he's 100% typical boy.
In the past, Connor had played sports for kids with disabilities, but no one kept score. And that, he told his mother, was not what he wanted.
Like any typical male, they're competitive. He wants to be out there playing and wants to go fast and wants to score, and, you know, now he can.
Connor, she says, has been playing now for almost 2 years and loving it.
It changed his life, which changed our life when he joined the team.
After the game, Connor's father, Pat Delaney, helps pull the players and their sleds off the ice. The Sharks lost 5-1.
Hello, Mr. Peanut. How are you?
Well, I'm sweating so badly. We have no subs.
I know.
During a post-game interview, I asked Connor about the game. At 9 years old, he handles it like a pro, spinning a loss into the makings of a great underdog story.
We are kind of a new team, so we are losing a little bit, but we'll get better and we'll keep on going and we'll keep trying and we're going to get better.
As far as Connor is concerned, he plans to keep playing the sport and, of course, winning for a long time to come. I'm Emily Friedman.
To see photos of the Sled Sharks in action, head to our website, metroconnection.org. When it comes to health and wellness, fitness is, of course, elemental. And with some folks in D.C., there's no need for the gym because they get plenty of exercise doing their everyday jobs. In the case of the woman we'll meet next, that job consists of pedaling around the city as she ferries documents and other important materials among people in official Washington. Kate Schrock is a bike messenger, and in this month's edition of D.C. Gigs, she stopped for a moment to talk with producer Mark Adams about the rewards and challenges of being a two-wheeled warrior in the nation's capital.
Hey, full health.
Good morning.
Right.
How are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Picking up?
Picking up,
ITC.
Okay.
I'm Kate Schrock. I'm a bicycle messenger in Washington, D.C. I'm 29 years old, and I've been a bike messenger off and on for 6 years. I was on my way to a job where I was a waitress, and I saw a bike messenger roaring down the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue and said to myself, this job sucks. I want to do what that guy's doing. I like being a bike messenger because you can do whatever you want all day long, mostly, and get paid to ride your bike. I'm not necessarily the breadwinner in the family right now. So I have a partner and she gets me benefits and we get insurance and stuff like that, it's dental. So that's, without that, I don't know what I would do. When we go to the embassies, it's usually taking passports, whether it's regular passports or official or diplomatic ones, and running them to be processed for visas. And then, of course, there's State Department work, which is papers that need to have stuff done to them. I don't know. I just pick up the envelope and drop it off. The amount of security in D.C. is one thing that sets it apart, absolutely. I have a belt that doesn't have any metal on it. All I have to do is take off my bag, toss it on the belt, walk through the scanner, and be done with that as fast as possible. Some places, like State Department and the EPA, the guards there are really, you have to stand and wait before you go, but other places you can just toss your bag on and walk through. But yeah, dealing with security is kind of one of those fine-tuned skills, I guess. You pick up along the way. Let's see what we got. A new job. Ooh, another one to ITC. Score doubling up. Another one. My lucky morning. Look at that. Select. The car door is probably one of our most dangerous nemesises. Fortunately, I haven't had a dooring in a long time. I tend to ride in the middle of the lanes these days. The fun stuff is when you've got 8 minutes to get to ITC and you're still up at McPherson Square and you got one more pickup and you're pulling out all the stops, you know, like rolling into loading docks and throwing your ID at them and grabbing the thing and running to the elevator and yelling at people to hold it and grabbing it, running down and just busting down Pennsylvania Avenue as fast as you possibly can. That's when it's fun, but it shouldn't be stressful if you're doing it right.
That was bike messenger Kate Schrock talking with producer Mark Adams. Do you have a distinctively DC gig you think we should feature on the show? Let us know by sending an email to metro@wamu.org. Everybody's working for the weekend. Now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Deanwood in Northeast D.C. and Columbia Pike in Arlington County, Virginia.
I'm Willa Jones, and I'm a resident of the Deanwood area of D.C., Northeast. I've been there 7 years in August. I decided to move there when I was looking for a house to buy because of the price. The price was lower than some other areas in town. This is one place I really could afford. At the time that I bought the house, I didn't know the name Deanwood. My house is about maybe 10 blocks away from the Minnesota Avenue Metro Station. But there is a Deanwood Metro Station kind of on the other side of Minnesota Avenue. A lot of houses are brick. If I go maybe one block down and make a right and go down Blaine Street, there are a lot of single-family homes. A lot of the houses are very manicured. You can tell where the homeowners are because the houses look really upkept well. The yards look nice. I see lots of kids. There's a school about 3 blocks away, a charter elementary school. There's a D.C. public elementary school, and then there's that junior high school that's also just right down the street. Some years ago, about 3 blocks from where I lived, there were a lot of public housing. They've knocked all of it down. They put townhouses there. There are like 5 or 6 blocks of townhouses all around there. I just think that Deanwood is up and coming. Throughout the city, wherever there's a metro, they're building more apartments and more upscale stores.
My name is Inta Malice, and I live on the west end of Columbia Pike in the Columbia Forest neighborhood. Columbia Pike is a neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia, and it is located on the south side of Arlington. It is a 3.5 mile corridor that stretches from the Pentagon to the Fairfax County line. Much of Columbia Pike was built in the early 40s in anticipation of the Pentagon being built. So much of our housing stock is from that era. The Columbia Pike community was once identified as the world in a zip code. This is a very diverse community. It has people from all over the world living here in all walks of life and all levels of income and background. If you drive down Columbia Pike today, you see new buildings with new stores, new restaurants, new apartment buildings. The iconic feature of Columbia Pike is the cinema and draft house. That is the center and the heart of Columbia Pike. We designated that as a historic building, but it's also a fun and great place to actually go to. Columbia Pike, in my view, has always been forward-thinking, and I'm pretty proud of that.
We heard from Willa Jones in Deanwood and Inta Malice in Columbia Pike. Your community can be a part of Door to Door, too. Just send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. And to surf around an interactive map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Sabri Benashour, Jonathan Wilson, Kavita Cardoza, Emily Friedman, and Jessica Gould, along with reporter Mark Adams. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Jonna McCone, Lauren Landau, Peter Domingos, and Heather Taylor produce Door to Door. Thanks as always to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website, that's metroconnection.org. And while you're there, you can find us on Twitter, you can join us on Facebook, you can listen to individual Metro Connection stories, and if you want to listen to the whole show, just go to the top of the page and click the podcast link. We hope you can join us next week when we're all about traditions, holiday or otherwise. We'll meet a bluegrass band celebrating its 40th anniversary on the D.C. music scene and visit a local church whose Christmas pageant is more like a Broadway extravaganza. Plus, a theater company in Fairfax, Virginia puts a whole new one-man twist on a holiday classic.
When I thought about what stories of the holidays that I would be excited about telling, I thought about Capra's It's a Wonderful Life and its enduring nature. And I think that's what I first really thought about was why does it have such an enduring nature?
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.